This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. It's spring, but we're all stuck at home. One thing we can do is celebrate the season by enjoying the birds that visit our backyards. It's an exciting time of year for birding, and we're joined by three guests who are here to share some tips for identifying, attracting, and appreciating the birds of Indiana. They are Executive Director of the Indiana Audubon Society, Brad Bumgardner. Good afternoon, Brad.
Thanks for having me.
Board President Amy Wilms. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
And Chief Naturalist of Wild Birds Unlimited, John Schaust. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. And good afternoon.
Today's show is pre-recorded, so we can't get your questions or comments in front of our panel, but we do encourage you to interact with us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, and we'll do what we can to get your questions answered, should you have any. Brad, let's start off broadly for anybody who might not be familiar with the Audubon Society. What do you do?
Well, the Indiana Audubon Society is pretty unique amongst Audubons as well, is that we are the fourth oldest Audubon in the country, and we are organized to promote birds, whether it be education, conservation, research. Birds are one of those charismatic megafauna that everyone attaches to. Whether it's the bright colors or the flight, it's a group of birds, a group of animals, that is, that is easy to have a lot of folks that have a love for. And Audubon helps to do that in a lot of different ways.
How did you get involved? How long have you been a birder?
Oh, I've been a bird watcher now for over 30 years myself, and I personally did a lot of camping as a kid, and we used to go to state park programs, and I remember going on a bird walk when I was 9 years old, and it kind of took off from there.
Have you had a so-called, and this may be a funny question for the group, I don't know, but have you had a so-called big year before?
I haven't done a big year in the grand scale. That if you've seen that big year movie around the country, I have tried to see as many birds as I can in Indiana. 300 is a pretty good number if you can see that in a year, and I was able to accomplish that a couple of years ago with a little bit of work.
So for people who aren't familiar with the concept of the big year in the bird watching community, what is that?
So it kind of takes the hobby of bird watching and turns it into a sport, so to say. You have in Indiana, there's over 420 bird species that we've been able to see throughout time. And it's just a chance to kind of get out and try to find as many birds as you can in 1 year or a lifetime or a county. There's a lot of different ways you can subdivide that. And so it kind of gives a little extra incentive for folks that like to go out and kind of collect, instead of stamps here, it's tick marks on a checklist. And it's a chance to see and hear all these amazing birds that we do have around.
So do you keep a log yourself?
I do keep a list of the different birds I've seen in different countries, different states, different years. Fortunately, a lot of bird watchers and nature enthusiasts have something called eBird today, eBird.org, and you can go there and log in your sightings, and it'll actually keep track for you.
Where do you like to go in Indiana to do this? I mean, you can go just about anywhere, but where are your favorite places?
Yeah, certainly like to travel all around the state, and we have some amazing areas. Indiana Audubon just came out with what's called the Indiana Birding Trail. You can go to indianabirdingtrail.com and actually see our listing of the top 60 sites all around the state that you can see birds, and they have a lot of amenities and that are basically catered towards bird watchers and bird enthusiasts. But I have a personal favorite, and that's the Indiana Lakefront. The Indiana Dunes National Park and Indiana Dunes State Park hold some of the highest diversity of bird sightings from all over the state. But that doesn't mean there isn't other great areas, too. So if I'm not up on the lakefront, then I do like Indianapolis has Eagle Creek Park. And down south near Bloomington, we have Goose Pond Fish and Wildlife Area. So those are probably my top three areas.
So what are the differences then between those areas? Let's just focus on those three because you picked a pretty diverse group geographically. What could we see up on the lakeshore versus central Indiana versus southern Indiana?
Yeah, Indiana is not quite a large state in terms of bird diversity geographically. So where we're looking for is habitats. So wherever you have a lot of different habitat types, you're going to have a higher diversity of birds, whether it be forested areas, wetlands, or prairies are the main three that I can think of. And so up on the lakefront, not only do we have all three of those, but we have a gigantic lake that is serving to funnel birds. It's an obstacle as well as a resource for migrating birds. And so it concentrates birds along the shoreline there. And then get down south towards Goose Pond, and here we just have a massive, extensive wetland restoration area that's surrounded by a lot of cornfields. So it's literally a magnet for migrating birds, and they see this large wetland habitat. So it's a great stopover for so many bird species.
And Amy, part of your role is manager of the Mary Gray Bird Sanctuary. Can you give us a little background?
Oh, sure. Husband and I both were co-managers of the Mary Gray Bird Sanctuary. It is a little over 700 acres, and it provides habitat stopover for migrating birds. And we do a lot of research out here. It's beautiful. It has walking trails, different habitats, four ponds, and it's open to the community.
And so as far as research at the Mary Gray Bird Sanctuary, how does that go? How do you do research there?
So we have a banding program at the Mary Gray Bird Sanctuary where as a master bander in the summertime, we do a MAPS program. We're monitoring avian populations in the summertime to see who breeds here. And we put bands on the birds and then see if we recapture them. We're trying to get the data off of that. We also do hummingbird banding here at the sanctuary. And we also do northern saltwood owls. So a lot of the research goes on along with the education piece when folks come out to be able to see what we do.
And so what does banding show us? Is it migration? Is it where they go? You know, what all does it tell us?
Well, that's a great one. So banding, when we put a band on a bird, our goal is to recapture the bird because the bands don't have any kind of tracking device on them. So what we learn from birds is, number one, who breeds in locations during migration, timing of migration, and when they come and when they leave. And it teaches us about the health of the bird and the longevity of the bird. So, for instance, if we have a bird that comes back year after year, we can start to determine and look at how long these birds live. So what's really fascinating is we had a pair of indigo buntings that have come back for 3 years in a row, same timing each year. So that's showing us that these birds actually do come back to the same location.
Wow, really? They come back to the exact same place every year?
In fact, I'm sure we'll talk about hummingbirds in a little while, but hummingbirds will actually come back to the same feeder that they left from the year before. And that's after traveling all the way down to Central America and back. So it's really fascinating that they'll hit the same feeders. They'll even hit the same feeders on their routes, on their migration routes. And pretty much through banding, we know that time-wise, they'll hit those same feeders at the same time each year, almost to the hour and the date. It's totally amazing.
Do we yet know why that is? Do we have any idea?
That's an excellent question. And I think that's what we're trying to figure out. Some birds are able to use the magnetics of the earth to migrate. We don't quite understand.
John, you're the chief naturalist for Wild Birds Unlimited. There are 10 stores in Indiana. What is Wild Birds Unlimited?
Wild Birds Unlimited is a franchise system of bird feeding nature shops. It's all throughout North America. We have about 350 stores in the U.S. and Canada. It is started right here in Indianapolis. Jim Carpenter is our founder and still our CEO. He started it in a very small little store right across from Broad Ripple High School about 35 years ago. And has grown that into a very, very successful franchise system that really, truly, you know, brings and illustrates the joy and the number of people that are out there that enjoy backyard bird feeding as a hobby day in and day out.
So the founding of Wild Birds Unlimited has very, very local roots?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I had no idea.
Yeah. The main, our headquarters is just, up in Carmel. And, again, it's been 35 years ago. Jim had been working in a landscaping business, and decided he wanted to do his own thing and was always into nature and birds. And he opened a little bitty nature shop. And I think it was like 800 square feet, in a little building that was right across from Broad Ripple High School.
So what do you do as the chief naturalist for Wild Birds Unlimited?
Well, one of the things we really want to have in our stores is to make sure that our stores and our staff and our owners are really, truly be a backyard bird feeding and the birds that come to their customers' feeders, that they are up to speed on all types of things that are going on in the world of birds. They're aware of the new research. They're aware, Jamie was talking about in bird banding, some of the wow things that we have learned about birds and bird behavior and migration and lifespans and that type of thing. So my job is to make sure, one, that our stores are really the best source of local knowledge and expertise on the hobby and about those local birds. And then also make sure that all the information that's going out from our system is accurate and really on the spot in regards to interesting and new materials, and also our products. One of the things we take great pride and great care in is make sure that all of the products that we sell in our store under the WBU Wild Birds Unlimited brand name are absolutely the best they can possibly be, that we've tested them, we make sure that they're safe. And I also play a big role in developing new products and new foods and things like that that people can put in their backyard.
So we can find feeders and we can find feed, which includes seed and suet and a number of other things. What else can we find at Wild Birds Unlimited?
Well, you name it. If it has to do with enjoying your backyard in many, many ways, it is certainly all the bird feeders and the foods and the wide variety of foods. It's housing, nesting boxes for everything from, you know, barred owls on down to house wrens, our Carolina wrens, that type of thing. But there's also bird baths and water features. A lot of our stores have some gift and garden items in their store, and various other, depends on the store. Each store is actually independently owned and operated. So really, while all of the stores share a core group of hobby products, branded hobby products, each owner has the freedom to bring in their own line of gift or garden or books or whatever it might be.
We are talking with the Chief Naturalist of Wild Birds Unlimited, John Shoust. We also have Board President of the Indiana Audubon Society, Amy Wilms, with us, and the Executive Director of the Indiana Audubon Society, Brad Bumgardner. When we come back, we are going to identify some common birds found in Indiana by their calls and songs, and we'll talk a little bit more about the birds of Indiana on this spring day. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with Board President of the Indiana Audubon Society, Amy Wilms, Chief Naturalist of Wild Birds Unlimited, John Shoust, and Executive Director of the Indiana Audubon Society, Brad Bumgardner. And we're talking about spring birds of Indiana. And we're going to play a little game right now, guys. One way that you can identify birds is by sight, of course, but another way is by sound, by listening for calls and for songs. And I'm going to play some of the sounds that I've heard in my backyard, and I'm sure many people hear in their own backyards, but maybe they don't know what they are. I certainly don't. And so we're going to kind of get into that part of birding. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
Go for it. Let's do it.
Okay. So when you hear the song or the call, whoever gets it first, just call it out. Here we go. Does anyone know that one?
That sounds like a house finch there.
That was absolutely right. That's a house finch. Brad, what do we know about the house finch? What does it look like? And can we attract it to feeders, or do feeders not work?
Yeah, house finches are one of our common urban and suburban birds that no matter where you live, you're probably going to get them at your feeder. They have that kind of reddish wash over a brown body. Females are a little duller, but the males... have that beautiful song and the red coloring, and it's one of those birds that no matter where you live, you're going to have them coming to your bird feeders, and they're pretty common to see.
Hey, Matt, an interesting side note on those: the house finch was not in Indiana until what, Brad, around mid 80s?
Yeah, about early 1980s.
They were actually a Western species, and they were introduced to the eastern part of the United States through the pet bird trade. They were being sold in pet shops in New York, and they were released when the pet stores found out that they were going to get, that was illegal, and they were going to get busted for it. And so from about 100 birds that were released around New York City, they've now populated the entire eastern part of the United States. And I remember I was a naturalist up at Potato Creek State Park when that happened, and I kept watching my feeders because we kept hearing that they were getting closer and closer to showing up in Indiana. So that's kind of cool.
Well, but is that in any way, John, problematic? I mean, we hear about invasive species and non-native species and things like that. Has the introduction of house finches since the 80s been in any way a bad thing?
The only problem they had is that the fact that the genetic diversity of that group coming from about 100 birds is very narrow. And so it makes them a little more susceptible to some of the diseases that the birds can get. But that seems to be going as successive generations keep coming and going. That seems to be mitigating a tad bit. But as for outcompeting most of our native birds, doesn't seem like it's created a huge problem. We've not seen any kind of decline in other, backyard birds or bird feeding birds or anything like that.
Okay, we're going to do another one here. We are going to hear another common bird that we can find in our backyards. I'm pretty sure you guys are going to have no trouble with this one.
Cardinal.
The Indiana State bird. All right. So why? And it's not just the Indiana State bird. It's the state bird of so many surrounding states as well. Why is this bird so beloved, Brad?
Well, obviously, if you've ever looked at a cardinal, bright red, so it's really one of those that's really highly loved by folks. It's a really great sign to see in your backyard, whether it's the summer when you're nesting or even in the middle in a snowstorm on a winter's day. So just bright and charismatic bird. And so it's really no surprise that actually we have 7 states that have made it their state bird. And it happens to be our logo for the Indiana Audubon as well.
And okay, so this is a terrible aside. I don't know why I'm asking this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. The Arizona Cardinals. Are there any Cardinals in Arizona? Do we know?
Actually, there are a few, I believe, that have shown up in the Arizona. There are more and more Cardinals, not on a big scale, but more and more Cardinals have made their way west over the years. And so, yeah, they're not very common, if at all, but I think there's been some reports of Cardinals there.
Okay. So just a little explanation for sports fans who might be joining us right now. Okay. So, all right.
They're the Cardinals though, because they were originally in St. Louis where there were lots and lots of Cardinals.
Right. Of course. Okay. So let's hear another bird. Here we go. I don't think we'll have any trouble with this one either. I'm throwing some easy ones for you in the beginning.
Blue Jay.
Blue Jay is right, of course. Blue Jays, though, have a great diversity of calls and songs, as I understand it. They can also, and correct me if I'm wrong, can they mimic in a way?
They have a couple of calls that people mimic that relate to, like the pump handle call. They have a call that kind of sounds like the old up and down action of a well pump, things like that. But they're not the mimic that some of our mockingbirds and mimic thrushes and even our starlings are actually very good mimics.
I've also heard the pump handle sound described as kind of a squeaky wheel, that kind of a thing. So when you hear something like that, probably that's a blue jay, or are there other birds that sound like that as well?
Well, some people, there's a whole group of birds called warblers. And one of the, what we're talking about is what we call mnemonics, where you kind of take a phrase and you relate it to the rhythm and pacing of the call. In other words, a Carolina wren has a very loud vocalization, and people paraphrase it in a mnemonic called tea kettle, tea kettle, tea kettle, tea. And it's the same pacing and rhythm of that call. Some birds you kind of have that. That's a great way to learn bird calls, and you kind of have that phraseology that you can help to remember the bird by.
Okay, we're going to hear another one here. Just if you know it, shout it out.
It's a robin.
That's a robin.
Yep, definitely a robin.
So the robin was the very first bird I ever knew as I was looking at it. I mean, because they're everywhere, and they're commonly seen on the ground. You don't have to look up into a tree to see a robin. You know, they're always everywhere. What explains the success of robins, Brad?
Well, robins are certainly an abundant bird that take advantage of early migration. In fact, their scientific name is Turdus migratorius. And so they will go down as far south as they need to, so they don't have a set wintering range wherever they can get away from snow. And they're one of the first ones that come back every spring. And they're real generalists, is that they can eat a lot of different types of insects, but then they can switch over to berries. And so when you can eat everything that's out there, you're kind of like the raccoon of the bird world. And so you're really abundant and really successful. And robins and a few other things like blackbirds I can think of follow that to a T and end up being out there by the millions and millions. And you see flocks flying right now over your head. And one of my friends, when he sees them migrating, he has the same thing he says every time: heading to a neighborhood lawn near you.
Okay, let's hear another one that I have a few questions about this one here.
Red-winged blackbird.
Red-winged blackbird.
Red-winged blackbird is correct. Now, I see these on my way into work. There's always one on a few road signs that I pass. Why do they perch in those sort of noisy, windy areas? I mean, is there an explanation for that, or is it just coincidence that I see one in the same place every single day?
Oh, they're totally on territory. You know, they display, they hold territory. They're kind of an interesting bird. They're kind of the Casanova of the bird world. They actually will hold a harem of 5 to even up to 15 birds within their female birds within their territory. So they kind of ride herd on the territory. They ride herd on their harem of females, and they do so by displaying, standing up, and all the calling and songs they have, but also those big red epaulets on their shoulders, flashing. Whoever's got the brightest red and the biggest red patch can be a dominant red-winged blackbird and can hold more territory and attract more females.
And what is the difference visually between the male red-winged blackbird and the female red-winged blackbird? John, you can take that one. Or Brad.
Yeah, that's definitely a fun one, because I think the female red-winged blackbird is probably the most misidentified bird that we see on social media, people posting, what the heck is this bird? Because they do not look like the males at all. They're even not even the same size. They're a little bit smaller. They still have that long blackbird bill, but they're really brown and streaky with kind of a bold stripe right behind the eye as well. But just all brown and white. You don't see any of the black or even much of the red on the shoulder even.
Okay, we have another one here. Let's hear this one.
House wren.
I think goldfinch, though.
Brad's got it. Goldfinch. I mean, it was a very, very short clip, and house wrens, I would imagine, can sound like that as well. The American goldfinch can be found in Indiana. I saw a couple on my feeders over the weekend. It is the Iowa state bird. Tell me about the goldfinch, Brad.
Yeah, they're coming back right now. I just saw a few of them flying around. Of course, some of winter, but there is a good migration of goldfinches as they'll return. But, you know, a lot of goldfinches were around all winter. Just folks don't realize it because they change plumage. And so they're not that bright yellow with the black on the wings that we're used to seeing in the summer. It's a much more muted olive type color. But right now, most of us are seeing all of our goldfinches change back to that summer plumage. And they'll be visiting our feeders again, going after thistle seed. And kind of interesting is goldfinches are actually one of the last birds to breed every year. So even though they're arriving now in April and May, they'll actually wait until the natural thistle plants outside have flowered and gone to seed, and they'll use that for their nest lining, and then they'll actually feed their young that thistle seed.
Amy, I have a question about hummingbirds. Do we hear calls from hummingbirds?
Actually, we do. If you're at your feeders or nearby them, you'll hear a clicking sound. And also, when I'm banding them, they have this little muse sound. That they make when I have them in hand.
So is it a sound, though, that we can hear easily, or do we really have to be listening for it?
You would really have to be listening for it, because you wouldn't necessarily be standing by a tree and know that there was a hummingbird there. And the other thing that you normally hear, though, a lot are the males when they're flying. You can actually hear their flight sound. And every once in a while, you'll even think that there's a jet going by
because they can fly so fast and whiz past folks.
All right, let's hear another call here. Here we go.
Bluebird.
John, was that you?
It was.
John, tell me about the Eastern Bluebird.
I don't think there's a much cooler bird for people to have around their yard and coming to feeders, and that's a whole new phenomenon. I remember back in the early days, a long time ago when I first started birding, to find a bluebird back in the 70s and the 80s was a challenge. They were that scarce. Their numbers had declined dramatically, and a lot of people started building nest boxes and putting out bluebird trails, and boy, has it done its job. Bluebirds are now really come back strong. They're very abundant. This winter, I probably had at least a dozen coming to my feeders, which is just unbelievable. And they're just the blue. I mean, think about how much that brightens a winter day when you've got these gorgeous sky blue birds with the rusty red chest sitting out there on your feeders. I actually have them coming to a window feeder right on my window. So they're right there. Just a very cool bird. It's one that you can actually, depending on your habitat around your yard, et cetera, you can actually put up nest boxes and have them a nest right there in your yard now. One of our conservation success stories for sure is the return of the abundance of the Eastern bluebird.
Hey, John, what are you feeding your bluebirds?
A combination of different things. Mostly they come to bark butter, which is a combination of suet and cornmeal and peanut butter. But we also have that in little bits. They're little pea-sized pieces of suet dough, if you will, and they come to those. And interesting enough, they've really become habituated to some small or medium-sized sunflower chips. So it's amazing to have watched them become a feeder bird. Historically, they were not a feeder bird. They would come mostly, and especially in the wintertime, to we'd attract them with habitat, fruiting shrubs that had berries like winter creeper holly and those types of things. But now they're definitely becoming a feeder bird.
John, are there other examples of a bird that has been sort of brought back into, I guess, commonality, much like the Eastern bluebird?
You know, I'm getting kind of long in the tooth in regards to, I've been doing this for 40 some odd years, and a bunch of my colleagues and I sit around and we talk about, we all came out of school in the 70s and we were going to be the Young Turks and we were going to change the world and save the environment. And most of them are retired. And when we get together and talk, we ask that very question is, you know, did we make a difference? And truly one of the things that we can point to is a number of these critically endangered species that were there in the 70s and 80s that have come back. The bald eagle being one that's just incredibly abundant now compared to what it was back in those days. But things like the peregrine falcon and various other birds and mammals that have come back. So, yeah, there are quite a few examples. I think the bottom line is those animals, whether it be birds or mammals or whatever, that we targeted as endangered species and as part of the Endangered Species Act, we have really made a difference. Those animals that we targeted, for the most part, have successfully returned to their abundance.
All right. Now, you mentioned bald eagles, so I want to play this. I know this is not a bald eagle, but can you tell me what this is? Okay. No. Wait, first of all, tell me what it is, and then tell me why you're laughing.
It's a red-tailed hawk. But you always hear in any movie you've ever seen when they show a bald eagle soaring, the bald eagle's not the most masculine, hardcore call. It's kind of wimpy in a way. So for some reason, most TV and movies have decided that it wasn't good enough. So they replaced the bald eagle's call with a red-tailed hawk call, the one you just played.
Yes, they do.
I'm going to play the bald eagle. Obviously, several birds can make several different calls, but this is an example of a bald eagle call.
Yep. Wimpy.
Oh, <wow. laughs> that's such a delight. Okay. All right. Well, I have one more call to share before we take a break, and that's this one. Tell me if you can identify this one.
Yeah, sounds like the European starling.
Okay, Brad, can you tell me about the European starling? Are they, I've heard that they are a pest, but I've also heard, I mean, I kind of like looking at them when they come to my feeder. What's the opinion on the European starling?
Yeah, versus the introduced house finch, European starlings and also house sparrows are two species that have been introduced from out of the country that do pose more of a risk and threat to native bird populations. Specifically, starlings will outcompete birds that are seeking cavities, so secondary cavity nesters, such as, you know, bluebirds and even like flickers and such. So they will be much more aggressive and kick them out. I know they make, if they're there for several years, I hear about up in people's attics when they can get inside, they build these big, massive nest colonies that you'll have more than one pair of starlings at. So they can be a little more of a detriment on the native landscape than some of our other introduced species.
We are on the line with Brad Bumgardner. He is the executive director of the Indiana Audubon Society. We're also joined by chief naturalist of Wild Birds Unlimited, John Schaust, and Amy Wilms, board president of the Indiana Audubon Society. When we come back, we'll talk more generally about some Indiana birds and attracting birds to our backyards. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with that in just 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back now with Amy Wilms. She is the board president of the Indiana Audubon Society. Also, Brad Bumgardner is the executive director of the Indiana Audubon Society. We're also joined by John Schaust. He's the chief naturalist of Wild Birds Unlimited, which is a series of stores, franchise stores that sell bird feeders and bird seed. And we are talking about the spring birds that make their way through Indiana and also who nest in Indiana. And Amy, I've got some hummingbird questions here for you.
Okay.
There is one hummingbird that nests in Indiana. What is it?
Yes. The ruby-throated hummingbird is the only hummingbird that breeds here in Indiana. They're quite fascinating, too.
Yeah. What can you tell us about the ruby-throated hummingbird?
Oh, sure. I could tell you a lot. I really enjoy spending time with them. They're arriving now in Indiana. They winter in Central America, and they make their way up north. They'll go all the way up to, some will go all the way up to Canada. Some will stop at our locations, and they'll be breeders. But the ones that are coming through right now are migrators, and they're going to keep going on up north to spend their time to breed. Their hummingbirds are the most fascinating birds. So they can fly up to 45 miles an hour. They can fly forward, backward, up, and down. Only bird that can fly backwards. And they only weigh about 3 grams. So if you can only imagine trying to fly 2,000 miles to Central America and making it back to the same location each year, that's pretty amazing.
So what other kinds of hummingbirds can we see commonly in Indiana? I understand there are a few species that come through, but as far as common ones, we've got the ruby-throated, which nest and breed here. But what else could we commonly see at our feeders?
So potentially, and this would be in the late fall into the winter, we might have a rufous hummingbird come through. It comes to the feeders. It's a little reddish-brown bird. It's a little bigger than the ruby-throated hummingbird. And surprisingly enough, they're very cold-hardy, so they can survive a cold night or two. And there are a few other hummingbirds that could potentially come through, like the calliope hummingbird and the Allen's hummingbird. But those are extremely rare.
Yeah. Are there hummingbirds, I guess, that are technically hummingbirds, but you wouldn't think that they are by maybe the way that they fly or things like that? And when we think of a hummingbird, we think of this bird that whose wings move so fast, it seems to hover and things like that. Is that a trait of all hummingbirds?
Yes. Of most of the hummingbirds, their trait is that their wing beats can go anywhere up to 80 times a second, which is pretty fascinating when you think about it. It's a figure eight as they are flapping their wings. And that gives them the lift so that they can fly fast, they can get around, and it helps them stay away from the predators too.
Now, I want to talk more about attracting and feeding hummingbirds a little bit later, but I want to make sure that we talk about attracting and feeding birds in general. John, you're the chief naturalist for Wild Birds Unlimited. I'm just going to share with you my bird feeder saga here for a second. Before we were put on lockdown, so to speak, I took my two-year-old to the local hardware store for a few things, and I noticed the bird feeder section. I thought, well, it'd be nice to have outside the kitchen window, and my son enthusiastically agreed, as two-year-olds do, and so we bought a seed feeder, a suet feeder, and we put them up, and it's been a delight watching them. And we got a little book so we can identify some of the more common species, and the more I look into it, though, the more I found that the type of bird feed that you buy is really important. Now, I got the cheap stuff, the really cheap stuff, and I got a lot of it, so I'll be set for a while, but the birds aren't going through it very fast for what I can only assume are obvious reasons. Why is getting the right food for your feeders important?
Yeah, it's a great question, Matt. And it really is important because it's such a waste, to be quite honest. A lot of the less expensive seeds that are available out there, the blends of different types of seeds, really aren't formulated for the birds that are here in our area. They contain a lot of seeds, Milo and wheat and canary seed and various other seeds that are fairly inexpensive to put into a blend. But at the same time, the birds here, with a few exceptions, do not eat those seeds. So it really turns into a waste of money because you're buying a lot of bird seed that never gets eaten by the birds. And it turns into a waste of resources because all this seed was grown and put out there, and it's really not going to, you know, serve its purpose. And it becomes a problem because a lot of the birds, you know, those seed blends may have some millet in them, which a lot of our birds like. They may have some sunflower seeds and that type of thing. So the birds go to that feeder and they see all the stuff that they don't like, but mixed into it is the stuff they do like. So they sweep with their bill. They get rid of all the bad seeds and just select the ones they want. So all that seed ends up on the ground under your feeder where it will spoil and rot and cause problems. So it really, really is important to buy a really high quality blend that is really specified or formulated for our area.
And so I think this is probably an obvious question, but does the type of seed that I buy attract a certain kind of bird? Like, can I buy a certain kind of seed to attract a certain group of birds, or are there just better blends that will attract just about every bird?
Yeah, there are lots of different blends that are kind of geared towards, you know, whether you have woodland birds like chickadees, nuthatches, titmice, those types of birds, that woodpeckers that are woodland birds. There are other blends that maybe have more things like millet and sunflower chips that are sparrows. Some of our white-crowned, white-throated, our juncos, our towhees, those types of birds like more. And so you pick the blend, again, if you have a certain habitat and a certain number of different birds that are coming to your feeder. So you can really dial it in to feed those birds and not the other ones.
So what would, I guess, a bag of good bird seed typically cost me? I mean, I can't remember how much I spent, but I know that it was the cheapest thing the store had.
Yeah, that's really hard to say because, you know, there's a whole variety. It's bird feeding has come a long way in the last 20 years. And one of those things is this variety of seed and seed blends that are out there. There's a whole group of what we call no mess. And those are seeds that have the hull removed. And so it's just sunflower chips. It's all the different seeds like millet without the husk on the outside, et cetera, et cetera. You get a bigger bang for your buck with those because you're not paying for all the weight of the shells that are removed. And it's a cleaner feed. When you put it in your feeders, the birds don't reject it. If it falls on the ground, it'll get eaten more than likely by other birds. So those bags of the no-mess type blends are more expensive. You know, you could pay somewhere, say, $30 for a 20-pound bag of those. But you're getting more bang for your buck because it probably one bag of that would equal two bags of bird food blend that is still in the shell. And so it's hard to say what an average price would be, Matt. And it's not just seeds. Again, bird feeding has really evolved. And so there's all types of different. There's suet And there's this bark butter that I've been talking about, and lots and lots of different types of things that are used, like suet. Woodpeckers love suet. And so if you want to have, I literally am sitting here watching a pileated woodpecker on my suet feeder at this very moment.
Oh, wow. That's a big deal,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, literally. I wish I had a camera I could show you. So I would never, you know, I wouldn't just put all my eggs in one basket of using some type of a seed blend. I would always have suet feeders and my feeding station to attract all the different woodpeckers. You literally can get 7 species of woodpeckers if you have the right habitat at your feeders on any given day with suet. And then this bark butter I keep talking about is just a wonderful thing to attract lots and lots of woodland birds and woodpeckers. Bluebirds love it. I've been having a wave of brown creepers over the last couple of weeks, which is a little bitty guy that runs up the side of a tree. That's what he does, and for a living, looking for insects, but they love bark butter, and so they've been coming to that bark butter spread.
Brad, you're the executive director of the Indiana Audubon Society. I'm curious what kind of bird feeders you have and the seed that you use.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of diversity, just as John's talking about, using different types of seeds. My go-to is sunflower. I love black-wheeled sunflower seed. I think you get a really good bang for your buck. It's high protein, high nutrients, and if you're looking at all the birds that like different seeds, there's a large diversity that will go for sunflower. So if I want to not spend as much money and get the most amount of birds at my feeder, then I like to use sunflower.
So how often, Brad, do you find yourself buying bird feed? How quickly do the birds go through your feeder?
Well, that changes a lot seasonally. So in the wintertime, I'm using more seed, and about every week or two, I'm going to buy 20 or 30 pounds of bird seed. And in the summertime, a lot of birds have dispersed, and they're not feeding their young seeds. They're eating insects and berries, and so the feeders tend to quiet down, or it changes, and the goldfinches start visiting, and I'm spending money on thistle. So it really goes up and down with the season, even monthly.
How interesting. Now, I would have thought that it would be the opposite, that your feeders would deplete a little more quickly in the summertime, but it's not quite the case?
No, because if you think about it, you know, once spring's come and everything's flowering and fruiting and insects are coming out, you have just this big supply of food that nature's providing for all these birds. And so in the end, we watch a lot of birds, and we do a lot of bird feeding, and we're concerned about the birds. But a lot of the bird feeding that you do is really for us. It allows us to be able to enjoy the bird. There may be some cases where you might help a particular bird through the winter if it's rough out, but most of these birds are pretty well adapted to surviving out here in this native environment, no matter the weather. And bird feeding is truly just for our own enjoyment.
All right, Amy, let's talk about hummingbird feeders. I've heard that some people say those should go out on Mother's Day. Is that true?
So I always recommend put those feeders up now. I usually like to put mine up early April, and just as long as you keep the feeder clean, just put a little sugar water in the container and put it out, and you never know what hummingbird you might be helping along its journey up north. So get those feeders up now, and I also suggest in the fall, keep them up as long as you possibly can. As long as they don't freeze, you're not going to stop a hummingbird from migrating, so get them up early.
So it seems to me like almost any time of year is a decent time of year for a hummingbird feeder, unless there's a freeze.
Exactly. So they're normally not here in the wintertime. Of course, they travel on down to Central America. However, you never know who you're going to help, especially if a rare bird comes along the way and needs to have a little substance to live or survive. You might be helping someone out. So I say keep them up.
So I guess for people interested in putting up hummingbird feeders, what should they know? How do you make do you call it nectar?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we use a sugar water solution, and I tell folks save money. You don't have to go out and buy the commercial mixes. Just take four parts of water to one part of sugar, and just mix that up and put it in your hummingbird feeder. You don't need to boil it. In the past, we always recommended to boil the sugar water, but there's really no reason to, because as soon as the bird starts drinking from the container, it's already contaminated. So just go ahead, put that up. And then once they're up, kind of keep an eye on it. We really want people to have clean feeders. So make sure that if it's really hot outside, let's say 90 degrees or hotter, those feeders should be changed out about every other day. And you don't want to get a hummingbird sick from some spoiled sugar water. Just keep it clean. And to clean your hummingbird feeders, all you need is good old-fashioned hot water. Just wipe it down really well and put sugar water back in and put it up, and the hummingbirds will be waiting for you.
Okay. And so it's one part sugar to four parts water. And
yes.
What about the whole food coloring thing?
No, please don't use red dye. So a lot of folks will try to put red dye in it thinking that will attract the hummingbirds. It actually doesn't attract the hummingbirds. It could harm them. And I just highly recommend, and so do the hummingbird experts, just you don't need it. So don't put it in there.
Brad, how does keeping an eye on the weather factor into birding?
Well, we're in the midst of spring migration, and you have this general thought that south winds are going to bring up these birds. And for the most part, that is true. We're always looking at the weather forecast to kind of predict bird migration. And this has almost become a real science now with groups like the Cornell Lab of Ornithology tracks and predicts bird movements based off of weather patterns. But it's far more complex than you might think, actually, because up here, like on the lakefront, we might be looking at more of a north wind that brings birds in from the lake down to the shoreline. And so sometimes the worse the weather, the better the birding in some of these locations. But obviously right now with spring, south winds are the ones that we're looking for. And whenever there's a good night of south winds, you can actually literally see it on the radar where it's not rain that's moving, but it's waves of birds that are being detected as they're winging their way northwards from the southern United States or even as far as Central and South America.
John, we've managed to spend most of the hour so far not talking at all about the pandemic, which was kind of the idea, and I'm really glad that we have, but it's a factor in everything right now, so we kind of have to talk about it. I want to ask how business is at Wild Birds Unlimited. You're the chief naturalist. How is it right now that we're all kind of on lockdown?
It is absolutely amazing, Matt, to be honest with you.
Really?
We have probably 95% of our stores have closed their sales floor. You know, they've closed the store basically, but they're still taking orders online, phone orders, curbside pickup, and the volume of sales has been just literally unbelievable. This is obviously, I think about, you know, when people are out there trying to find toilet paper and hand sanitizer and that type of thing on the same trip, they're swinging by the Wild Birds Unlimited store to pick up the bird seed too. And I think it's just because it is, if you're stuck at home, this is something that every single day, every single time you look out that window, you're probably going to see some bird that's going to give you just a little moment of peace and tranquility, a little bit of joy. And I think a lot of people just do not want to be without that as long as they're quarantined or stuck at home. So, it's been remarkable to see how our stores are, I won't say thriving, but how they're surviving and doing well during this whole situation.
Well, I want to thank each and every one of you for your time today and your expertise. This has been just an absolute joy, just as much as it's a joy to look out at my new bird feeders, even though I've got the cheap seed, and see so many great birds coming through this time of year. He is the chief naturalist of Wild Birds Unlimited, John Schaus. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Board President of the Indiana Audubon Society, Amy Wilms. Amy, thank you.
Hey, thank you too.
And Executive Director of the Indiana Audubon Society, Brad Baumgartner. Thank you so much, Brad.
Pleasure to be here today, Matt.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director. Get our podcast wherever you get podcasts. Subscribe so you always know what we're talking about. Catch up if you have some time. If you enjoyed this diversion from COVID-19 coverage, let us know. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Back this time tomorrow. This is All In.